Heal Thyself, Using a Holistic Approach with Dr. Eric Madrid.
Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to today's podcast. I'm very excited. I have a special guest, Dr. Talha Memon. He received his bachelor's degree in biology at New York Institute of Technology. He completed his family medicine residency at the University of California, Riverside, where he was awarded Intern of the Year. In addition, he did a fellowship in sleep medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, which is one of the most prestigious programs in the nation when it comes to sleep medicine. He's double board certified, not only with the American Academy of Family Physicians, but also he's board certified in sleep medicine. So we're going to talk to Dr. Memon. He's going to talk to us about sleep apnea and how to one can diagnose sleep apnea and what are some of the symptoms and dangers with sleep apnea. If you're new to this podcast, we welcome you. If you're not yet following me on Instagram, please make sure you do so at Eric Madrid MD. Also, if you enjoy this podcast, please make sure you leave us some feedback on Apple Podcast. And we'd love to hear any comments, any feedback, whether good or negative. All feedback is appreciated. So thank you and stay tuned to this excellent, excellent interview.
Hey, Dr. Madrid.
Yeah. Hey there, Dr. Memon. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great. Thank you for joining us for the podcast today.
No, thank you for having me. This was very nice of you to set up.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you are not only a board certified family doctor, but also a board certified in sleep medicine. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, I am.
All right. And can you share with the listeners what exactly is a sleep medicine doctor and what is it exactly that you do?
Sure. So with respect to sleep medicine and what exactly is it that I do, sleep medicine entails, addressing people's needs that have difficulties either going to sleep or staying asleep, or people that sleep perfectly fine but feel very, very sleepy all the time. So sleep medicine kind of delves into figuring out why people don't sleep the right way, why people sleep too much or too less, and diagnosing problems and issues and addressing them. The most common diseases that we deal with include sleep apnea, great, which we'll be talking about today, insomnia, which is, you know, difficulty either falling asleep or staying asleep, restless leg syndrome, and then, excessive sleepiness.
Gotcha. So I remember growing up thinking, realizing how we spend almost a third of our time sleeping. And to me, it really seems like it's kind of a waste of time, so to speak, right? I think a lot of people feel this way, especially people with type A personalities. We have a lot of things we want to get done, a lot of things we want to accomplish. And here we are spending a third of our time simply sleeping. And it doesn't seem like it's a very a useful and efficient use of our time. However, obviously sleeping plays an important role just to our overall health, the strength of our immune system, and so on. Can you kind of explain what actually occurs during sleep and why it's so important to the human body?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of sleep, it's a natural process for your body to recover, to recuperate, to rejuvenate. And if you don't give your body enough time to sleep, your body won't be able to recover or rejuvenate. Think of it like charging your phone battery. And if you don't fully charge the battery the next day, it's not going to last as long. And it's kind of a similar sort of concept with the human body. If you don't give it the right sleep and you don't give it time to recharge, the performance is going to suffer. And they've actually looked at patients. They've done multiple studies in the sleep world in terms of patients that sleep less than 6 hours or patients that sleep more than, a specific amount of time. Is there an effect in terms of their overall health? And what we have found is Patients that sleep less than 6 hours are typically at risk for cardiovascular disease. That includes like heart attack, stroke, diabetes, they're at increased risk for cancer as well. So sleep not only helps you, you know, feel more rejuvenated, but actually overall helps your medical well-being.
And so a lot of people, just because they're in bed, just because they're sleeping, just because their eyes are closed and they're snoring the night away, that does not necessarily mean they're getting quality sleep, right? So there's a condition called sleep apnea, which, you know, if you can explain that, because, you know, I've seen a lot of patients, they have daytime sleepiness, fatigue. Occasionally people even get in car accidents because they fall asleep at the wheel. And a lot of, you know, high blood pressure that's difficult to control. Eating disorders, maybe where they just can't control their appetite, they're eating a lot. And a lot of this actually has to do with them not getting restful sleep at night. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So the condition that you're referring to is described as obstructive sleep apnea. It's a condition where your upper airway, so your tongue potentially will fall back and hit the back of your throat. And when the tongue falls back and hits the back of the throat, that's what causes the snoring noise. When you potentially have that occur, that can block airflow of air going in and out of your body. So when air doesn't go in and out of your body, you stop breathing. So it's kind of interesting because, you know, back 20, 30, 40 years ago, snoring was considered normal in sleep. In fact, you watch Tom and Jerry and some of these, you know, right, older cartoons, Popeyes, they depict sleeping by snoring. Now we're finding out that actually snoring isn't necessarily a good thing. In fact, if you do snore, that's probably usually associated with having sleep apnea oftentimes. And sleep apnea is a condition where you stop breathing multiple times at night. You might not realize it, but you might stop breathing 5, 10, 15 times an hour. And if I were to wake you up, you know, 5 times an hour, or if you're basically choking yourself 5, 10 times, 15 times an hour, guess how you would feel the next day? You would feel like you got no sleep. You'd feel tired. You'd feel exhausted. You'd feel sleepy. So car accidents and drowsy driving are very, you know, commonly seen in patients that have really severe sleep apnea.
What is the most, in your experience over the years of reading sleep studies and conducting sleep studies, what's the most you've seen a person wake up in a given night?
In terms of the times they have these pauses in breathing, I've seen values as high as like 150 to 170 times an hour. So that's nearly, what is that, like every 30 seconds?
That's insane.
Yeah.
Now, so one of the, misperceptions about this, or misconceptions, I should say, is that only obese people, only overweight people have sleep apnea. And if I'm skinny and my body mass index is under 25, if I'm normal weight, there's no chance that I have sleep apnea and that I just snore because that's how I am. Is that true, or what are the evidence on that?
Well, I guess there's some truths to both statements that you're making. In terms of weight plays a big role in terms of sleep apnea. In fact, I think if your body mass index is over 30, the chances of sleep apnea is about 70%. Now, simultaneously, what they also did was they wanted the sleep, when I say they, I'm referring to sleep physicians and sleep researchers, they wanted to see if there's any sort of demographic population that's more at risk for sleep apnea. So they categorized individuals as African Americans, Native Americans, Caucasians, Asians. And believe it or not, the most likely incidence of sleep apnea in non-white individuals are Asians. And the reason why is because of their craniofacial structure, their anatomy. So although they may be, you know, on the smaller end in terms of their body mass index, they might be smaller, but the way their jaw is structured, they're more predisposed to it. So sure, you know, weight plays a big role in sleep apnea, and if you're, you know, a big football player, there's a good chance you might have it. But you could be a small, skinny guy, and you might also.
Now, I noticed too, just on a personal note here, you know, about 6-7 months ago, my weight had gone up to about 247 pounds. I'm 6'3". That was the heaviest I'd been since medical school, and a lot of it was just due to the fact that I was eating late and my hours weren't optimal. I've since fixed that, and now I'm down to 205 pounds. But one thing I noticed is that when I was at that heavier weight, more according to my wife, I was waking up with headaches. I was tired during the day. I found myself coming home wanting to go to sleep earlier than I ever had in the past. And my wife had said, I better go get a sleep study. But being that doctors were not the best patients, I didn't, you know, listen to her. And I said, no, I'm going to simply lose weight. So I started doing the intermittent fasting and keto diet, and I got my weight down. And I'll be honest, a lot of my, I no longer snore. I wake up with energy. I feel better. I don't have headaches. So is it possible that I had actually developed sleep apnea as I put that weight on and now have maybe actually reversed it and cured myself?
Okay. Yeah, definitely. So you can actually increase your risk of sleep apnea or decrease your risk of sleep apnea by weight gain or weight loss. So if you were to gain 10% of your body weight, the risk of sleep apnea, I believe, increases by about 32%. So your apnea hypopnea index, which refers to the times you stop breathing at night, potentially goes up by that much. And now if you lose that weight, you can, you know, reduce the risk of sleep apnea by
about that. Okay. So in that sense, I guess I kind of dodged the bullet, but,
I think you may have gained the weight and potentially had a, you know, some degree of sleep apnea. And when you lost the weight, you may have treated
yourself. So for patients, I guess, who maybe were in a similar situation where they never had sleeping problems, all of a sudden they put on some weight due to one reason or the other and then develop a sleep problem, the option would be either weight loss and or, you know, if they're not motivated to do that, then a sleep study. And now, can you explain the sleep study? So how does a doctor or a patient even, how do we decide who should have a sleep study and when is it necessary? What is the requirements for that?
So ultimately, it depends on how you feel. And so if you're, you know, on a day-to-day basis, like you were having complaints of feeling tired and fatigued and you felt like your day was dragging or you were feeling sleepy. So those are all symptoms or signs that perhaps you need to get a sleep study. If that's accompanied with snoring or pauses in breathing. So if you don't realize that, if your partner realizes that, then those would be all, you know, red flags that, okay, I need to go get a sleep study. The most common type of patient that I typically see is that comes in with their partner because their partner complains of the snoring. So the partner complains, I can't stand, you know, his or her snoring. I need to leave the room. And that's usually the type of patient, you know, that I see oftentimes because that prompts the evaluation. But in any case, I think loud snoring or snoring, pauses in breathing, sleepiness, fatigue, tiredness, morning headaches, you know, waking up often at night, waking up in the morning not feeling refreshed, all are signs and symptoms that prompt an evaluation for
and
a
then
sleep
how
study.
About how about blood pressure too? So I understand there's some relationship between sleep apnea and blood pressure, and over the years I've had, you know, a few patients, for example, who we are unable to control their blood pressure with 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4, even 5 medicines, their blood pressure is not controlled, and then all of a sudden they are diagnosed with sleep apnea, and miraculously their blood pressure improves, and we're able to, you know, reduce at least the number of blood pressure medicines.
Yeah, believe it or not, there's a study that shows if you're on 3 or more blood pressure medications for men, the chances of sleep apnea is like 95%, and for females it's about 60-something%. So it's a very high incidence of sleep apnea in patients that have high blood pressure. The physiology behind that is if you're not breathing properly at night, your body's not getting the oxygen it needs at night because, you know, your tongue blocks your airway. Your oxygen levels drop in the body. And when your oxygen levels drop in the body, that causes your heart to panic. It's in a, you know, fight or flight state.
So your heart now is in an overdrive state at night instead of being in this relaxation mode. So in, you know, an overdrive state, and you know, at night consistently over the span of 3, 5, 10, 15 years, you develop a, you know, a higher risk of developing high blood pressure. In fact, not only do you, are patients at risk for developing high blood pressure, patients that have sleep apnea are also at risk for developing other sorts of cardiovascular diseases like heart attack, stroke, arrhythmias, or heart irregularities like atrial fibrillation. So there's a lot of cardiovascular risks that are tied into having sleep apnea. And therefore, this is one of the main reasons why I get a lot of referrals from cardiologists, just to reduce the risk of or incidence of these things.
So in a way, what you're saying is something as benign or seemingly as benign as snoring, which, the kids probably make fun of their dad or mom when they snore, that actual snoring may actually increase their risk of having a heart attack and dying. That is
correct.
And there's probably a lot of people listening to this too, who are going to, all of a sudden go home and, schedule a sleep study or an appointment for their spouse or family members to get a sleep test.
So I would definitely highlight that snoring by itself, and if you're not really feeling any other symptoms, not significant or not significantly significant, you don't have to go get a sleep study, but if you're snoring and if you have any of the symptoms that I outlined, then you definitely should get a sleep study. Or if you're snoring and you have a medical issue like a history of high blood pressure or a history of heart attack or a history of stroke or a history of heart failure or any significant medical history like along those lines where it's heart related, then I would definitely get a sleep study just with snoring.
Gotcha. So let me ask you, what about now I understand too, sleep is real important for two of our hormones. Ghrelin and what is the other one? Leptin. Basically, so people with sleep apnea are more likely to have food cravings and less likely to feel full when they eat meals. Is that some truth to that, or?
Well, that's all a product of just not sleeping. So I don't necessarily think it's the sleep apnea per se. There is 100% truth to what you're saying, but I think that's all related to not sleeping properly. So that's a product of I guess being a little sleep deprived. So if you stay up all night, you'd feel the same way too. That's why we get the munchies if we're up all night studying for an exam, if we're students or for projects.
And I guess if you're only sleeping 5 hours instead of 8 hours, that's 3 more hours that you're potentially eating more food. So that might be why people who don't sleep satisfactory will end up having a heavier weight, perhaps. Now,
absolutely.
Let me ask you, I've had patients over the years who say they have trouble sleeping, they're waking up at night, and so on. So they think that taking a sleep medication is the answer. Are there any dangers taking a sleep medicine like Ambien or Lunesta or Temazepam if a person actually has sleep apnea, or does that actually help sleep apnea?
Well, it may potentially worsen sleep apnea, but it doesn't really help it per se. Think about it. What we have, or what the issue that we have in sleep apnea, is a mechanical issue. We have an obstruction, and that obstruction needs to get corrected. If you take a pill like Ambien or Temazepam or, any other pills out there, Lunesta, they don't necessarily cure the obstruction. They just, allow you to sleep a little bit more. So. I don't ever recommend taking a sleeping aid if you have sleep apnea, because all you're doing is putting a band-aid on the problem. You're not really addressing the underlying issue.
So patients would go to the primary doctor. There's a couple of questionnaire forms out there that kind of test the patient to see if they have symptoms consistent with sleep apnea. And then the doctor will, if a person has the symptoms, as you mentioned, that are suspicious for sleep apnea, the doctor will then have the patient go do a sleep study. Can you explain what a sleep study is, what it includes, what is looked for, and what do they do with the results?
Yeah. So in terms of a sleep study, there's two forms of sleep studies, one that can be done at home and the other one that can be done in the lab. But in essence, the one that's in the lab is more detailed and more specific, more bells and whistles. The one at home is not as detailed. But in essence, what we're doing or what we're measuring for is we're measuring for your flow of air going in and out of your nose. We're measuring for oxygen levels. We're measuring to see how your breathing patterns. We're measuring to see your heart rate, your leg movement, limb movement activities. We're measuring your EEG, which is your brainwave activity. So we'll be able to tell when you're sleeping, when you're awake. And all of these things put together help us determine whether you have sleep apnea or don't have sleep apnea. So the main piece of information that we typically tend to look at on a sleep study report after we're done interpreting it is, what is your apnea hypopnea index? Apnea refers to a complete airway obstruction.
Right?
Correct. Where you stop breathing. Hypopnea refers to a incomplete or a partial airway obstruction where you still stop breathing, but not as significant, not as severe. And that index is what we use to measure how severe your sleep apnea is. And based on that index, we'll know what sort of treatment options we have. But usually the best treatment option that we have for all patients that have sleep apnea is something called a CPAP device. It stands for continuous positive airway pressure. It's a little portable device that basically pushes pressure or air down the device that connects to a tube that then gets connected to a face mask that you wear at night to sleep. So all the device is doing is pushing air down your throat to keep your airway open. So it works as an airway splint. It prevents the tongue from falling back and blocking your throat. So it's not oxygen you're getting, it's actually
gotcha.
Pressure.
Is it a loud machine or is it a big machine? How big is it?
I guess in terms of how big is it, I'd probably say it's about maybe half of a 8x11 paper size, maybe a little bit bigger than that, but
okay.
Just about that size or so. Is it a loud machine? It used to be. Back 5-10 years ago, it was extremely loud. The newer machines are pretty quiet. Actually, I shared a room with a friend approximately a year ago. We went to a sleep conference, and my colleague had the machine on, and he was sleeping in the bed next to me, and I couldn't even tell the machine
right.
was on or off. Or
Okay, good. So, again, someone who's listening to this, and the wife may kick the husband out of the bedroom and have them sleep in another room because they can't sleep from the snoring. If they're using the CPAP machine, then the husband can come back into the bedroom. Okay.
Well, that always happens.
That is great. What about people who can't tolerate the machine or, because I think for the most part, if a person sleeps on their side, it can be more challenging. If they're a back sleeper, is that correct? It's easier to sleep with a machine or...
Yeah, so as far as the machine is concerned, the key to success with the machine is really finding the right mask, and that sometimes is a little challenging. But for the most part, most people take about 2 months or so to get used to it. So if you start the machine, after hearing this podcast and use it for a couple of days and you say that this is not working, I would say don't give up just yet. You got to give it at least 1 to 2 months. Most patients typically take that long to get acclimated to the machine, to get used to it. It's something, it's something invasive on your face. It's going to take time to get used to it. And most people don't feel a benefit for about a month or so,
okay.
a month to 2 months, roughly. So you got to give it that much time. Now say you've tried, you've tried it, you've given it 2 months and it just doesn't work for you. There are other options out there. And that ties back to our conversation about how
mm-hmm.
severe your sleep apnea is. So if you have mild sleep apnea, and that's defined by your apnea hypopnea index score between 5 and 15, then an oral appliance may not be a bad idea. And an oral appliance is a little device that they make. You usually have to get it personalized through a dentist. It's a mouthpiece that you wear at night to help you sleep. And all this device is doing is moving your jaw forward, basically. So it reduces the amount of times your tongue falls back and hits the back of your throat. So this works really well in patients with mild sleep apnea. It works okay in patients with moderate sleep apnea. It doesn't work really well. Or it doesn't really work at all in patients that have severe sleep apnea. So if you're considering that, I would definitely make sure you see a specialist to discuss whether.
Okay, because not all dentists can do it, right? It's a dentist who specializes in sleep medicine.
Correct. I believe certain dentists even do it that don't specialize in it, but most of the dentists that feel comfortable doing it are the ones that usually specialize.
How about surgeries too? Are there some people who need to have surgery because of their sleep apnea?
Yeah, surgeries typically revolve around either fixing your septum, which is your nose. So if your nose is a little crooked, that may sometimes tend to help. Sometimes surgeries revolve around taking your uvula, so that little wiggly thing, squiggly thing in the back of your throat. They sometimes shave that off. Sometimes they actually even make a surgery to move your jaw forward. As far as the effectiveness of surgery, not really that great. I usually don't recommend it for anybody. The only scenario where I would recommend it is if we've exhausted and tried absolutely everything and nothing absolutely works. But usually what our research indicates is the surgeries tend to help reduce the sleep apnea severity by about 50%. So say you came in and you had severe sleep apnea, and you went through and got surgery, your sleep apnea might go from severe to moderate sleep apnea because it helped it, but it doesn't make it go away completely. So the problem lies in, well, you went from severe to moderate sleep apnea, but you still have it. So we still have to then address, you know, how to fix it still. So that's why it's kind of like a mute point with getting surgery. There's a new device out there that's called Inspire, and that's a pretty neat device. It is a nerve stimulator. It innervates, your tongue gets innervated by a nerve called hypoglossal nerve. So this nerve stimulator, it gets implanted into your body, and it basically gets activated when you sleep. So you have a little button that you turn on and off when you sleep. So when you get into bed and it's time to sleep, you turn the machine, you know, your button on, and your muscles and your tongue get activated, and it basically prevents your tongue from.
So where do they insert this device?
It's in your chest. It's not in the tongue. It's in your chest. It's a newer device. So in terms of long-term study outcomes, we don't know, you know, what the 20, 30-year impact is of having something like this in your body. But so far, the evidence and research looks pretty promising. So I'd say definitely sit tight and over the next few years to see what pans out of people that do decide.
Gotcha. But it sounds like at this point it's still kind of new. So it's not something that would be used first line. It would only be after failure.
I definitely not first line. This is something that we try, you know, in our bag of tricks. If we tried everything else and nothing works.
So can you share maybe a couple of success stories, like people who've come to you, were newly diagnosed with sleep apnea, and what type of improvements and changes they've seen in their life since having it adequately treated?
Yeah, I see this every day in terms of patients, and it's kind of rewarding because you see the difference in how they feel, and they come in and they're exhausted and tired and sleepy. They're not performing well at work. They're falling asleep during meetings. They go on and get diagnosed with sleep apnea and start treatment, and their life changes. Most of them usually say that I cannot live without my CPAP machine now because I feel so much more better. They feel like they get deeper sleep. They feel like they get more consolidated sleep. They feel more rejuvenated, more energy. And over time, what ends up happening, I've noticed with patients, is they just get used to feeling tired and fatigue, and that just becomes a norm for them. And they don't know what it feels like to just feel rejuvenated and refreshed. So once they get treated and they feel, you know, the difference, they're very appreciative of you know, the treatment option of the CPAP and you know, how much it changes their life.
So I imagine too, especially if weight contributes to it, it's one of those things where it's happened so progressively and so slowly over the years that you know, they spent maybe, you know, started in their early 30s and 40s, and then they're not getting diagnosed until their mid 50s. Now they just kind of assumed it was a normal part of aging. And I can imagine now they get it fixed and they probably feel like they're 20, 30 years younger, energy-wise.
Yeah, that's actually a very accurate description of how patients feel.
Yeah, that's incredible. How about its effect? Yeah. How about with diabetes too? Does it help people get their diabetes under better control if they have sleep apnea?
Well, we definitely know that you increase the risk of diabetes mm-hmm. if you have sleep apnea, and that's because your body's under extra stress. So the hormone cortisol would probably increase more so during the night because you're under stress. So I would imagine that with the CPAP, you would definitely reduce that, you know, that secretion of that hormone. Therefore, you would improve your diabetes.
Gotcha.
By that
now,
naturally.
Just another question here too. Now, sleep apnea, we normally think of adults and so on, but what's the youngest person you've seen with sleep apnea, and you know, at what age should a physician or a parent or, you know, be concerned that their kid might have sleep apnea?
So I trained at University of Michigan, and we had a children's hospital attached to our facility. And so I saw, you know, I saw newborns. I mean, I saw kids 6 months, a year, 2 years. I saw all ages that have sleep apnea. Now, there's different types of sleep apnea. So there's something called central sleep apnea that's a little more prevalent in younger kids. But as far as obstructive sleep apnea, with our conversation and discussion, that's seen in kids that are young as well. I mean, at 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, you can see it. And typically, sleep apnea in kids is associated more so with tonsils being extremely large or enlarged in size. So kids typically don't complain of, oh, I feel sleepy or I feel tired. Kids typically get hyperactive and misbehave, and so behavior is usually one thing that we tend to look at in children. ADHD commonly is often misdiagnosed, and instead of sleep apnea in patients, also in younger individuals. So we've seen a lot of that where patients have sleep apnea and parents think that they have ADHD, and they go down the road of diagnosis of ADHD and get Adderall. Later on, we find out they had sleep apnea all along, and it was simply treating the sleep apnea.
So in reality, the Adderall was working because the kid was sleepy and couldn't stay focused. So we give the kid a stimulant, and no one knows the difference.
Right, exactly. So the stimulant or the Adderall was just masking the.
Kids, again, it doesn't necessarily mean because they're obese. It could be, like you said, because the tonsils are enlarged, or maybe just the way their jaw structure is, that they're at higher risk.
Correct. Depending on the medical history, and there are certain things that will predispose you, but oftentimes the tonsils play a big role, or their jaw size.
And is there a genetic component to this too? So are children, you know, if the parents have sleep apnea, are the children more likely to have it?
Not necessarily.
And then can you briefly touch, so, or maybe this would be another conversation, but central sleep apnea, so there's obstructive sleep apnea, does that account for what, 95% of the cases, and then there's a percentage that's called central sleep apnea?
Correct. Central sleep apnea refers to when your brain doesn't basically tell your body to breathe. So you don't necessarily get, you know, the snoring noise or the pauses. You may still see the pauses in breathing, but you don't necessarily see snoring. Central sleep apnea more so is associated with certain cardiovascular diseases like heart failure. So if you have heart failure, there's probably a higher risk of developing central sleep apnea. And there's other neuromuscular issues and diseases that are also associated with it. Certain, you know, stroke can be associated with it. So there's tons of other associations with central sleep apnea and certain diseases, but treatment is somewhat similar in terms of a device that usually pushes air down your throat to help keep your airway open.
So, now, hey, I really appreciate this phone call and or this, you know, this interview, and you know, you definitely provide a lot of good information that I think our listeners will be able to use, and hopefully, if they're suffering from again this chronic fatigue, high blood pressure, you know, morning headaches, and they really need to get things checked out. Correct?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for
Absolutely. And I think we'd like to have you back on at some point in the future too. Maybe you can give what we were talking about earlier. Maybe give us a little teaser of some of the latest information here about sleep and athletic performance.
Yeah, there's so much data and information out there about how your performance as an athlete can be affected based on your sleep. Your instinctual, you know, 3-point shot, or your swing, or if you're a boxer, how quickly your reflexes are, all can be affected with your total sleep time and how much you're sleeping or how little you're sleeping. So next time we get together, I can go over some of the interesting data that's out there, and it's going to be mind boggling to you with how much of
do you think if I follow your advice in the next interview that my shot will be more like Steph Curry's and I'll be hitting those threes?
There's a good chance that won't happen.
It's going to take more than a CPAP machine to make that happen, huh?
Maybe if we train the 2K, that
perfect.
Might happen.
Perfect. All right. Great. Hey, well, we'll definitely have you back on, and we'll look forward to that information, because I think that would be very useful. All right. Thank you.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Have a great rest of your night.